Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net.
Hannah, before we get into our somewhat unique episode this evening, I want to share with you the wine, and it's not connected. You don't have to guess.
It's not connected.
But you know this wine. You know this wine because I bring it out annually.
Oh, you do bring it out annually, the Beaujolais Nouveau.
Every year, the new Beaujolais comes out about this time, and I just love the new Beaujolais. I mean, everyone kind of looks down their nose at a Beaujolais, but I just love this wine. And I saw it in the store today when I was shopping for the podcast, and I was like, oh, I'm getting two of these.
Well, you know, it is tradition, so I'm glad you were able to find it.
I mentioned this episode is going to be a bit unique, and it is. We're only going to do one standard review, and that's going to be of The Favorite. Coincidentally, probably a favorite for multiple awards this award season. And speaking of award season, our next topic after The Favorite will be the Washington Area DC Film Critics Association Awards, of which we are both in the midst of voting on and just killing ourselves watching so many movies, making sure we give everything its fair shake. And we're going to discuss perhaps how we're doing with voting, what we're leaning towards, what we're leaning away from,
what we're missing.
And I also believe you wanted to talk about an article we saw today about audiences.
Well, you're the one who posted it everywhere, so
I didn't know you were gonna
actually pay attention
to it. And someone threw some shade out there against audiences. We're talking about you people, you audiences. Someone thinks you're not doing your job. You're not up to snuff. So we're gonna talk about that.
Okay.
But let's lead off with The Favorite. So I went in blind on this, and it's good that I know a little something about the English monarchy, because if you don't, you might think this is just a completely fictional film, and it's not. It's actually very historically accurate, except, you know, for all the dialogue. But the players are real. There was a Queen Anne who ruled England in the early 1700s. So she wasn't the first Queen of England. You know, Elizabeth I was already back there over 100 years before her. And Victoria came about 100 years after her. So she's sandwiched in the middle. She's also a forgotten monarch. A lot of people never heard of Queen Anne. Who's Queen Anne? There was an Anne in Richard III. Nope, different Anne. And she was not a very inquisitive, a very lean forward, a very lean in type of queen. She had grief. All 17 pregnancies ended in either miscarriage or early infant death. She had gout. She was hurting. She was not in the right mind to be queen.
If she had 17 pregnancies, one thing that was missing for me was, who were the men?
She had a husband.
Which, yeah, but he doesn't really make much of an impact.
Depending on what year this is set, you don't really know. He might have already been dead.
That to me was a little confusing because I'm not all that familiar with the history of the British monarchy.
She was married to a no-name, just this prince from Denmark. Not Hamlet, but another prince from Denmark. And he died about 8 years before she did or so. And so I think this takes place, it alludes that she's not married in this film. So who, if not Queen Anne, has the reins of power in England? Who calls the shots? Who's everybody afraid of? They're afraid of Lady Sarah Churchill, played by a very strong Rachel Weisz. You don't mess with Lady Sarah. She calls the shots. She has the key. She has the privy purse. She scares the footmen. She yells at the maids. She owns Queen Anne. If Queen Anne walks out of her bedroom and Lady Sarah doesn't want to deal with her today, she'll make fun of her makeup and send her just back to bed. The queen. She'll send the queen back to bed. And the queen,
She's the Dick Cheney of the Queen Anne reign.
We saw Vice this weekend. There's a reason we have Dick Cheney on our minds. Queen Anne is played by Olivia Colman. You have to kind of know your British, I don't know, TV miniseries to really know who Olivia Colman is. She was also in a previous film of this director, which I think we'll bring up again, The Lobster. But Olivia Colman's also playing Queen Elizabeth II in the next season of The Crown.
Oh.
So it's no longer Claire Foy. Uh-huh. She's older now, and she's being replaced by Olivia Colman.
Okay. I can see that.
Yeah. And so Rachel Weisz is very strong, and she owns Kensington Palace, pretty much. And so let's make it a triangle. It's not just A and B. Let's bring in C. And C is Abigail Hill, played by Emma Stone, who just knocks on the door one day and says, cousin, Cousin Lady Sarah, I've fallen on hard times. I need a job. So she hires her just to be a scullery maid way down there in the bowels of the castle. This is directed by Yorgos Lanthimos. He's already been nominated for an Oscar for his first film, Dogtooth. I think it was best foreign. It was nominated for Best Foreign Film. We know him best for The Lobster. I loved it.
Yeah.
You
did not.
Somewhat okayed it.
But it was weird. It was one of those ones that this director, and same with Killing of the Sacred Deer, which he did as well.
He did.
This is probably the most mainstream of his films, but that does not make it a mainstream film.
And some people say it is the most mainstream because it's the first one he didn't write. He didn't write this. A lot of people say he gets in his own way. He's so out there, so experimental, so strange, you would say, that he gets in his own way of making a quality product.
Or just a product that will appeal to a broad swath of humanity.
But I suspect The Favorite will appear to a broad swath of humanity. There are those people who love costume period dramas. And when you categorize that in that genre, it's very strong. The costumes are amazing. The makeup is amazing. The cinematography, the palace porn, if you will, is first rate, top tier. Mm-hmm. Can't get better. But then there are others, Lanthimos fans or myself, who like a little bit of experimentation. And that's in here too. Some very interesting camera angles, like the fisheye lens. The dancing is contemporary. I love the dancing, by the way. There's some anachronisms in here to make you smile, to make you laugh.
But there's also some very witty dialogue. And I did appreciate that aspect of it. But it's not a top five favorite for me. So while some people are truly calling The Favorite a favorite for award season, I like it for best costumes. I mean, I like it for cinematography. I like it for a lot of those individual things. But on total, the movie was not, it was just okay to me. I'm not a huge fan of the period costume genre. I don't watch all the Crown and all the BBC shows. For those who do, yes, this is going to hit the sweet spot because it does have that very quippy, witty dialogue and excellent performances.
But I do not like period costume dramas either. In fact, I think you like them more than I do.
I doubt
it. And I loved this film because
it's so...
That's
because you got that lobster guy doing it for you.
Well, I am a Lanthimos fan, but I'm also a fan of a very sharp screenplay, and it's just I like this story. I like how they tie it all together, and the story is actually a little bit lewd, a little bit lurid.
A little bit, yes, quite.
They say, and it's based on Queen Anne's actual letters, which still survive to this day. And rumors, which have descended hundreds and hundreds of years now, that there was more to the relationship between Queen Anne and Lady Sarah. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink, you know what I mean. And Lanthimos even shows a scene.
Yes.
So Abigail Hill, Emma Stone, wants to move up in the ranks. She's very shrewd. She's very scheming. She wants to kind of take Lady Sarah's place. And to do that, she has to maybe take Lady Sarah's place in the boudoir. She does it as well. So I really connected with this story because, and another, did you notice this screenplay, Lanthimos, The Favorite, exalts the feminine? These are very, very strong female characters played by very strong female actresses, and everything is female-centric. The men are farcical. They're laughingstocks. They're aside.
They're there to support the women.
And even that, the men are mocked.
Yeah, yeah. But I did love Nicholas Hoult.
Nicholas Hoult's great. Maybe he might get a supporting actor from me. But he wants to be prime minister. He wants to use Abigail for his own means, his own ends. However, he spends almost all his time staring in the mirror, saying, look at my new wig. Look at my makeup. Aren't I so foppish?
Yes, he's very vain.
He's a dandy.
But his delivery was spot on.
It's
great.
Very funny. But he's not meant to be taken seriously.
No. And but even, you know, the Emma Stone character has a lot of layers. You don't really know quite where her character's going. And she sort of does a lot of the kind of wink, wink, nod, nod, you know, to several of the characters, and you just don't know what her agenda is for a while, which is interesting. But yeah, the guys are truly just sort of window dressing in this film, But that's sort of why this movie works as well as it does. It reminded me quite a bit of Love and Friendship from a couple years ago.
It had a very strong, not as strong a script, but a very strong mm-hmm. script. It's not as cutesy. I remember it was very cute.
But that's why I think that one appealed to me. This one's a little weightier, but I did, I remember being kind of pleasantly surprised by Love and Friendship. And I do think that if that's a movie that anyone actually happened to have caught and enjoyed, then they're more likely to definitely know that they'll be okay with The Favorite.
Well, we're on the leading edge of reviewing The Favorite. It's got a very slow rolling, limited release, which many Oscar bait movies do. And I think you're going to wind up to be in the minority on this. Olivia Colman is going to be a very strong Best Actress contender. I mean, right up there with Glenn Close and Lady Gaga. And surprisingly, Regina Hall from Support the Girls, who just won the New York Film Critics Society Award, which is out of left field, out of nowhere.
Yeah.
But Olivia Colman's going to be right up there.
And she very well could and should be. Again, she didn't make my top five, because when we have to choose, we're choosing our five. I would not be at all surprised to see her up there in the awards category. And that's fine. She is very good and very funny and just a very strong performance. But again, all three of them are. So it's what also would be considered a strong ensemble.
It is, yeah. And it just won the Best Ensemble Award at the Gotham Awards.
So, and I can see that. And that makes total sense.
Because maybe we shouldn't be. And Rachel Weisz pointed this out in her acceptance speech. She accepted on behalf. She said, everyone keeps asking me, how do I feel about this really female-centric cast and acting with other females? And it's like, would you ask men that question?
Well, but it's also interesting that my fear or concern always is that certain characters, certain actors cancel each other out in these kinds of films. So when you actually have Rachel Weisz and Emma Stone, both potentially supporting actors.
No, they'll cancel each other out. But Olivia Colman's going for the lead.
Exactly. But in fact, it is, to me, it's the trio. It's the dynamic between those three. And that's kind of a problem with the way that awards categories are, fleshed out these days, is that it forces people to make these choices and to put people in categories that aren't necessarily really the right category. For instance, you'd have to have Mahershala Ali and Viggo Mortensen for Green Book being put in, one gets put in the lead actor category, the other one gets put in supporting actor, when in fact it's the dynamic between the two equally that makes for a great film. And so I'm not sure. Someday I think they need to revisit how all of that...
Well, that's up to the studios, really, who they decide to push for what award.
Right. But we can watch it and think, this is equal weight.
All right. We wanted to... I had the idea, because we do this almost every year, is talk about our worst movies of the year. Because at this time of year, we're not going to see anything that's going to make our worst list. This is Oscar time. This is award season. And Hannah's too nice. Hannah, she doesn't like to actually, people, even in the really, really bad movies, people spend a lot of hard work and effort to make movies.
Well, and I skipped a lot that I had heard or figured looked so bad. And so this year was a really important year for me, where I watched a lot more movies that I would normally never have watched and kind of liked in your indie and foreign film Charlie category. And so when it came time to see some of these other ones that everybody, you just looked at the synopsis in the trailer and you were just like, this looks awful.
Well, I found plenty to make my worst five lists, but it's okay.
Other than Happy Time Murders, there's nothing that just springs to mind.
That's because you forgot certain movies.
But that's okay,
too. But we don't have to do this. I don't want you to know.
And if I've forgotten them, then why burden the listeners?
Can I mention one to you?
You can, please.
Because I had my whole honorable mention list and top five worst movies. And I'm not...
Run through them. Let's lay it on me.
Can I? All right. I'll get your... Because you've seen most of these.
Uh-huh.
Not all.
Okay.
The fifth worst movie of the year is Show Dogs. You didn't see that. I saw that with my kid.
Wait, what?
Show Dogs is...
What's that about?
Ludacris voices a Rottweiler who goes undercover at a dog show to solve a kidnapping mystery.
You know, the thing is that I think... Did I not? I'm not even sure.
You didn't see it. You weren't there.
All right.
You weren't there.
Skipped it.
You didn't see the fourth worst movie of the year, which is Born Guilty, Rosanna Arquette. Just terrible film.
Nope.
Just, God, I don't even want to talk about it. I don't even want to tell you what it's about. But you did see the third worst movie of the year, The Happy Time Murders. Mm-hmm. And I have no problem with Muppets and movies. I like Muppet movies. But this one,
yeah,
this over-the-top, lewd and crude and really just disgusting Muppet movie with Melissa McCarthy is terrible.
Yeah, I agree.
You saw the second worst movie of the year, and I think you would agree if you had remembered it. Basmati Blues.
No, actually, I did remember Basmati Blues, and I was going to bring that up.
Rice Nine.
What was so funny is that, you know, we do look back at this time of year at our master list of everything that we've seen, and Basmati Blues did jump out at me as one of those ones that I wouldn't necessarily...
You tore that movie apart.
Oh, my God. It's so... But it was fun. It was so bad that I enjoyed
Donald
watching
Sutherland
it.
Sang a song.
It was so, it was terrible.
He spoke a song.
It was terrible, but
Scott
not...
Scott Bakula.
But not so terrible. Like, Happy Time Murders, I just was like, oh, this is just, I'm not liking this at all. Basmati Blues, I'm like, this is so bad that it's funny that I can't even imagine these incredibly talented people are all participating in this film. And so... That to me is there's a certain value in seeing some of those really bad films, and I'm telling you, there is a cheesy value that that I think some people, if they stumble upon this movie, will actually get a kick, have a glass, a couple of cocktails.
There are movies that are so bad they're good. The Room. This is not the Room.
No, this is not The Room, but it's it is so bad.
The Room is good.
The Room is good in hindsight, but Basmati Blues is just one of those funny ones where you just are kind of like, wow, you know, Tyne Daly, I think, was in it, and Donald Sutherland, and what's her name from Room.
It was before she got the Oscar, let alone became really famous, Brie Larson.
Right.
This was shot years before.
But to see Brie Larson, who actually did sing, I think, before she acted... It was just this bizarre.
You have these rose-colored glasses.
I tore
this movie apart.
I didn't. I think if we go back and listen, you'll see that I actually said pretty much what I'm repeating now. That it has a certain cult classic quality.
No, this is not going to be a cult classic. Nobody's talking about this movie.
No, but if somebody stumbles upon it in 10 years and if Brie Larson is still doing really good stuff, it's just one of those ones that will haunt her forever, but will be dusted off periodically to just show that mistakes do happen. But it's still, to hear her sing and to hear them bust out into some of these songs that are just so over-the-top inappropriate and weird.
She's also a white savior, saving Indians from themselves,
It has all sorts of problems, but that's why, I'm not sure that I would have necessarily called it... If I had to choose my worst, I would put it on that list, but there's a difference between painful to watch worst and, you know, that was bad, but I'm not sorry that I at least had the opportunity to see it.
Well, you also saw the worst movie of 2018, yeah. You saw it, and it hurt. It hurt so bad. I'm talking about Ken. Ken. Do you remember the kid who finds the alien gun?
Yeah.
And then they go to then the son kills Dennis Quaid, and then they go to the strip club to hide out. And
but again,
it's the worst movie of the year.
It's the worst movie. It's one of the worst movies of the year, but it's not one of the worst movies ever. And so
it's so bad.
I will put my rose colored glasses back on and just remember that again. It was not painful to watch. It just you came out. And
I
you were
physically
like,
hurt.
Yeah, I think I was much kinder to Ken than you were.
All right, my honorable mention list. You know what a bad movie was? Night School.
It was weak. It was disappointing.
Why are you so nice?
No, and that's my thing is, and when I told you, if we actually were to do this list, that rather than me calling them the worst movies, my list for the end of the year for worst movies is actually those films that I was just most disappointed by. That's included for me.
So you were at least disappointed by Night School.
I was disappointed because I thought it had much stronger
potential.
Especially
with Tiffany Haddish.
Maybe. It had a lot of potential, and it just it failed to meet it.
You know what a bad movie was? Viper Club. Susan Sarandon.
Yeah, that was really, again, that was disappointing. I was expecting way more out of that one.
You know what a bad movie was?
Well,
Gauguin Voyage to Tahiti.
Oh yeah, that was that one was like sort of. Do I have to keep watching this one? That was pretty bad.
And the final one on my worst of the year honorable mention list is a documentary. Hannah, you know what a bad movie was? Westwood punk icon activist.
That was a pretty bad.
Remember the girl who didn't want to be in her own documentary?
Yeah, yeah, that was one where you're just like, look, honey, if you don't even want to be featured in this documentary, just let them turn off the camera and put this one to bed. Yeah, I agree that as documentaries go, and this was actually a very strong year, I think, for documentaries, that one, that was just not very good.
Well, moving on to what we consider to be some of the best, and this is not our best of list. That will be a separate podcast. But we are both voting right now, and you mentioned this is a strong year for documentaries. And the DC Film Critics have a very unique category amongst other critic societies. We have the best portrayal of Washington, D.C. in a film. And my number one on that was a documentary, and also my favorite documentary of the year, which is RBG. Standing for Ruth Bader Ginsburg. It is my number one documentary. It's my number one portrayal of DC because she's a fascinating woman to watch with a fascinating history and backstory that many people don't know about. And it's a treasure to watch her work out in the gym wearing a sweatshirt that says Super Diva.
But here's the irony. I actually put as my top pick for that particular award on the basis of sex, which is the dramatized version of the Ruth Bader Ginsburg story, or a sliver of it, that is coming out at Christmas time. And so I actually thought that the portrayal of Washington in that film was just sort of resonated a bit more than it did in the documentary. And so while I have both of those in my nominations. So it's interesting because it's essentially two different sides of the same coin. And so, it's an interesting category. Sometimes we really struggle to come up with what really deserves to be there. As we mentioned, we saw Vice, you know, it's a portrayal.
Careful. We're not really allowed to
talk about that yet. But so I'm just saying DC, obviously Vice would be, would have something to do with that.
So we were very busy this week, and we saw so many movies that are coming out pretty much on Christmas Day that we're not allowed to even share our most basic opinions with. I'm talking about Vice, which is Christian Bale as Dick Cheney, and I'm talking about Mary Poppins Returns, which we saw, which are still not allowed to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, there is reaction out there.
I have a reaction.
but we're not allowed to formally state it yet. But these are all ones that we still are. And, I mean, things, but there's also the more out there stuff that we've seen. Like, I did watch Destroyer with Nicole Kidman so that I'd know what that one, whether that was worthy of bumping something off of my current list for best ofs. So we're stockpiling all these different reviews and films, and it's going to be really hard to go back and actually remember what I saw.
I've been in catch-up mode. I had to go back and see things I missed. There are already winning awards, like First Reformed, mm-hmm. which just won New York Critics and Gotham Awards, and Ethan Hawke as the lead actor in that film. I am not going to nominate First Reformed for anything personally, but I see why people love it. It's also by Paul Schrader. Once we talk about that article, is another man we're going to bring up again, Paul Schrader. He wrote Taxi Driver. Yeah. He wrote Raging Bull. And now he wrote and directed First Reformed, where Ethan Hawke is a very conflicted, grieving, and alcoholic preacher. It also stars Amanda Seyfried. Not a bad film, but
no,
nothing I'm going to nominate.
And I did put Ethan Hawke in my list for Best Actor. So while I wouldn't nominate anything else in particular from that film, I thought Ethan Hawke's performance was stellar. But I also did just catch up on Widows, and we've been talking for weeks. We keep saying, yep, that's one we need to see. That's one we need to see. And so I finally watched that this afternoon. And it's, again, it's a good ensemble. I put it in the mix for Best Ensemble because it's got three very strong women, all, again, kind of leading the charge in this one. I didn't love it. And I talked to a neighbor who had seen it, who really did like it, but she mentioned that it would not be everyone's cup of tea. It's a rather violent crime drama thriller. And, Viola Davis is being bandied about for her role. She's very good, but, I did not love this film all that much to put it ahead of some of the other things that are kind of in awards contention right now.
I caught up with Can You Ever Forgive Me, which is baffling why Melissa I think McCarthy. So many people are falling in love with this film. Melissa McCarthy in a dramatic role as a forger trying to make ends meet and stay afloat. And it's not really her name that's being mentioned as best actress. The picture is being mentioned, and so is the supporting actor, Richard E. Grant.
Richard E. Grant.
And again, yeah. I see why people are nominating him. I'm not going to because I think I've seen this character before.
I have, but I think I threw him in because to me he was one of the strongest parts of that film. I saw it at Middleburg Film Festival quite a while ago, and that's why I was pretty surprised at the reaction to the number of people who were putting it out there for awards, and Melissa McCarthy's name has been bandied about for Best Actress for it, and I did not see that. I thought it was just a standard good movie. It was like a good, interesting biopic based on a true story, and so I was interested in understanding what had happened to this biographer who was forced to forge things in order to make a living when the work for her just kind of dried up. And Melissa McCarthy is very stripped down in this role. But it's still underneath. I still saw bits of Melissa McCarthy in some of her other characters. And I think I would consider this movie possibly for best adaptation, because I do think it tells the story very well that we just didn't know about. And so I think it did the best it could with that raw material. I was not blown away by this film, but I've talked to others who really, really liked it. But we're seeing so many movies, and some people are only seeing a sliver of what we're seeing. And so they're liking something because they haven't seen anything quite like it. And we see a lot of stuff that's like a lot of other stuff.
You're right. You're absolutely right. I noticed that unlike previous years where, you know, say you squeeze in 12 to 14 films in the last week before you vote, and you're killing yourself on which one can I bump out so I can put this one in. And I'm not having that problem this year. I'm seeing okay films. I'm seeing fine films, as you would say. I'm not seeing films that are blowing my hair back that are making me find space for awards. I have plenty of space still for awards that no one's really rising above the pack.
Right. I it's like my top three choices. We're allowed to nominate five things in each of these categories. And I would say that my top three in all of those categories are far and away my favorites. And the final two slots, I'm kind of being pretty random in how I'm picking them, because there are probably 10 equally weighted, similar types of performances or screenplays or all the other various categories that one does not necessarily rise above the other. But my top three are definitely my top three. And so I'm just hoping that when the Washington Area Film Critics Awards actually are announced on Monday, that at least one of my top three picks has at least made that cut.
Mine usually don't.
Yeah, you and Christian. Our friend Christian Amaker, who has a hard time, I think, with getting his picks.
He's plugging one we just talked about a week or two ago. He's plugging Border, which was about the troll from Sweden, which I liked more than you did, but neither of us.
But we were both okay
with it. I did really like it. I really liked that film.
And I was okay with it, which is, you know, for me, for some of these weird foreign films, is actually quite a
for you, considering what you usually do to those films, you were a big thumbs up on that.
Yes.
All right, there was an article we bandied back and forth today, and it was written by Paul Schrader. Paul Schrader, who we had just talked about, he directed First Reformed. He's famous for writing Taxi Driver and writing Raging Bull. He's been around a long time. And he says, you know, we would make more serious movies. People say, Hollywood, why do you make such garbage films? Why don't you make more serious movies? And you're like, you know what? We did. It was called the 1970s. All the studios were making serious movies. And you know why? Because audiences were serious. It was a serious time. They wanted serious movies about social commentary, about politics, about Watergate, about the hard-hitting racism that was still prevalent in still is today, but even more prevalent back then. And you know what happened? Audiences became unserious. They didn't want serious movies, so they failed at the box office. Therefore, Hollywood and studios said, all right, we're not going to make these bombs anymore. We're going to make Bumblebee. We're going to make Transformers 7. We're going to make Shrek 6.
But they're making... No, the problem is I think they are making all of them. So they're making those big ones, and they're getting all the marketing bucks, and they're getting all the trailers and the buzz. But then these smaller ones are also still getting made, but they're not getting a fair share. And so I think in the 70s, I don't recall weeks where there were literally 5 to 7 movies that were coming out every Friday and would last in the theater for maybe 2 weeks. And if they didn't do well enough, they'd be yanked for something else that was coming in. And so I don't think that's a fair assessment. I do link to that article in the review of First Reformed on Chick Flicks, but because Artie Chick really liked it. She loved this film. She found it very thought-provoking, First Reformed. And so my point of view is that it's very thought provoking, but it's also quite bleak. And people just, I don't blame people for not wanting to go see Bleak if they can go see Mary Poppins Returns, or if they choose to see something that's more standard uplifting or just simply entertaining and enjoyable, especially at this time of the year. So I think to sort of put the blame on the audiences is unfair, because I think the times have changed in so many ways, and it goes to marketing, word of mouth, and just this push that if it doesn't do well in its opening weekend, then it's sort of the same thing with TV shows now. They don't do well enough in their first 5 episodes, they're gone.
Well, look what happened to First Man. That didn't do very well in its opening week, and it's gone already. The same Green Book also had the same problem. But I wonder if that's because, and we're better now at big data. Big data really didn't exist in the 70s. So studios, and especially their statisticians and financial heads, know. They already know before the movie comes out kind of what it's going to make. So why risk it? Why put your money in this independent that could, maybe this is a couple times a year it happens, this crazy indie will end up making $100 million. Happens every year. But you have to make 200 of those for two to
right,
make it.
But they're making 200 of them now, and so you're waiting for those two. And so Green Book, it's sort of, you know, you're just kind of, I'm constantly amazed.
And that one's funny.
It's good, and it's funny.
That's not serious.
I know. It's got... It should appeal to so many people.
It bombed.
And I don't understand why it's bombing, because anybody who does go to see it is basically telling somebody else, oh, you know what? That really is good.
And those type of movies live and die by word of mouth.
So I don't understand what went wrong with that one. Blindspotting is another one that deserved way more attention, didn't get any kind of for your consideration love from its distributor.
I didn't even get a screener for that.
No, nobody did. And yet I did still put it in my best of list, because I'm like, you know what? I saw it. I think it was great. I liked it far more than Black Klansman, which got so much more attention.
Which we got a screener for.
And we got a screener for.
Is that because it has a director called Spike Lee?
Yes, exactly. As opposed to two unknown, you know, two,
a known
two
quantity
friends.
Who's somewhat of a box office draw.
Yeah.
Therefore, studios will put money behind
yeah,
it.
Yeah, but that's not the audience's fault. So for Schrader to blame the audience, I don't think that's fair.
Well, maybe explain, because the audience, why, you know, they'll put Dirty Grandpa on top for a week, and that, you know what, that is the audience's fault. That's their fault. I'm blaming you, audience, for doing that.
Well, why does Tyler Perry open all of his movies gold? Because he knows it doesn't matter if they suck or if we think they're going to be really bad. He's got a built-in base, and so if you've got a built-in audience that will make that money. But I think it's the filmmaker's responsibility too then to make sure that the marketing and that the actors, that everyone behind the film does everything they can possibly do.
But one of your excuses you haven't brought up yet, you said in 2018, specifically, people do not want to go to the movie theater to see a serious film because they're on Twitter all day and it breaks their soul.
No, this time of year. I would say it's more this time of year. And so to me... as the holidays approach, it's the political landscape.
That's what I was getting at.
Yeah, that makes a huge difference.
Is that why the front runner bombed?
I think so. Nobody needs to be reminded that Gary Hart would have actually been elected now and been a much better president, you know, the change in the political landscape. And I think that everybody wants to escape this crazy reality that we're in a little differently than they did. And yeah, you know, I think the mindset in the 70s and with all the scandal going on then and with the war, and it was just you didn't have 24/7 news. You weren't getting all of this stuff through 100 other different means. You weren't getting it on your Twitter feed and on your Facebook feed and on 6 different all news channels. The films were sort of a secondary way to experience what was going on. And you don't get, today you don't need that. It's like, you don't need to see what you've already seen in 1,000 other places.
You know, that's why I stay away from certain documentaries. Like, there's one we're going to talk about next week, Divide and Conquer, about Roger Ailes. I haven't watched it yet, but
I will.
I'm going to watch it,
yeah.
But I really don't want to.
No, me too.
I really don't want to.
And I felt that way a little bit about, actually the one that I did really like that I put into the mix for that DC Portrayal Award was the first 2 hours of the documentary Watergate that I had seen, and I think it was just on the History Channel. But it was released for a week just to be able to, I think, get some nomination. But it's a very, that one was really good. And that's sort of an exception. But I think it's why the Michael Moore, didn't really hear anything more about the Michael Moore documentary, Fahrenheit 11/9.
That faded.
That totally faded. And that's because I watched that one and I was like, I don't need to relive this.
It's too early to relive that stuff.
Yeah, we'll talk about Vice. I feel in some ways it's too early to relive that.
It is. And that was, it's actually comparatively a while ago.
And Front Runner, it just isn't an interesting enough story to float up. I love Hugh Jackman. We'll definitely check out his world tour. But the Front Runner to me, just I can see why it just wasn't going to resonate with anyone.
Well, next week we are going to get back to our standard reviews. Like, we're talking about Roma. We're going to talk about Vox Lux. We're going to talk about the Divide and Conquer documentary. But we're also going to talk about the Washington, D.C. Film Critics Awards, which are released Monday. What is that, the 3rd?
December 3rd, I believe.
Ish. And so we'll dissect what we're very happy about, or in my case, what I can't believe people voted for. I'm very excited to do the voting process this weekend.
I know it's going to be a late night, but I'm looking forward to just cramming in maybe one more thing based on. I know
that's hardcore.
It's hardcore, but we'll see if anything miraculously shows up between the time that we see what's been nominated for the final ballot. If there's something I feel like I really need to watch to give it an accurate placement, I'll do that. But otherwise, I'm pretty confident in my choices this year.
All right, quick recap. We talked about The Favorite, which really is one of my favorites. I think it's just a fascinating, another great film by Yorgos Lanthimos, and I believe Hannah was a bit cooler.
I'm much cooler, but I will say it's my favorite film by Lanthimos. And we'll just leave it at that.
Fair enough. And then we talked about my personal bile of film list, my worst film list of the year that Hannah... I liked every single film on that list more than I did.
I just didn't hate it as much as you did.
I don't know. Is there any film you actually hated? Can you name one film
Happy
you
Time
hated?
Murders.
You hated that film.
I pretty much hated
it. It's fascinating because you just don't say that.
No, I pretty much hated that one.
Then we talked about what we're leaning towards, what we're leaning away from for the awards. And Paul Schrader, I am with you a little bit. I think audiences not necessarily have gotten dumber, but just...
Times have changed, you gotta go.
They're looking for something else.
And at Christmas time, Thanksgiving,
not
Hanukkah,
even Christmas time. I think all year round, they're just looking for something else.
Escape is escape, and you can't tell people what they should be escaping to when they go to the movies.
Well, I wish I could. You know, I wish I could just like, hey,
you try. Come on. I give you credit for trying your best to guilt people into seeing things that they really don't want to see. But on the broad scale, I just think
who doesn't want to see a movie about a Swedish troll? Come on,
with the weirdest sex scene you'll ever see on,
and it's not
on
animated;
screen.
It's a real movie.
No, absolutely. So I think we do our part in elevating some of these films that might otherwise not get any recognition. And so hopefully, you know, throughout the course of the year, when we say that something that's small deserves that word of mouth and deserves to get checked out, I just hope people realize that if both of us like it, there's probably a chance that it's
the only reason
really
this podcast works is because we are just different people, just different.
Exactly,
I don't like what you like.
I know, but every once in a while, something like Green Book comes along,
and you like that a lot more than I did.
You just go, if we both think it's good, and it's the same concept with chick flicks.
No, it's like the ones we have truly loved is the ones that really like Three Billboards, Hell or High Water, like. We truly both treasure those films, and it turns out so does everybody else.
And I really wish you'd seen Blindspotting or had a chance to see it, because I actually think you would like that one.
I was too busy being on the 8th grade bandwagon.
That's right. And 8th grade's another one that we kind of threw out there that we both liked.
Oh, I'm nominating her for Oscar, for actress, not even just best youth performance, but actress.
Yeah, and I would just mention really quickly that this other movie, Becoming Astrid, which is, I think, Sweden's entry into
is it
Sweden? No. I think so.
No, yeah, Border yeah. is Border. It's gotta be.
I don't know. Artie Chick said
no. It's from
was,
Sweden, but Border is Sweden's entry.
Maybe, but so I don't know. Maybe Artie Chick needs to amend her
let's fact
post.
Check that.
But she actually Artie Chick reviewed it, and she said that she found it to be a lovely biopic.
Who's
about
it about?
The, it's about the early life of Astrid Eriksson Lindgren, who would go on to write the children's classic Pippi Longstocking, which
Pippi.
I did love as a
good old Pippi.
I did love it as a kid. And so she Artie Chick says that it's actually a very it's just a good biopic. She enjoyed it, and I think it's one that I would hope to try and catch up on maybe, but
not this week.
It's another I know it's another one of these empowering girl power stories, and there's quite a few of those this year. So, that's going to be tough to find and to fit in under the current circumstances. But if you're a huge Pippi Longstocking fan and have always wondered about the source material, then you might want to check out Becoming Astrid.
All right. Very good. Well, thank you for taking the time to listen to this preamble to the WAFCA Awards. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.